This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
So, how many people have come to the other talks in this series so far? I'm just curious. So, a little over half of you. So this is, as Jennifer said, the third talk out of a six-part series on recollective meditations. It's a less commonly practiced form of Theravada meditation here in the West, but it's alive and well in Asia, let me tell you. And these kinds of meditations are a little bit different. They're an intentional adverting of the mind to a topic or a theme, or even an emotional quality. And they still involve mindfulness, but they're also aspirational a little bit. They both recollect one's own past behavior and aspire to emulate people or beings who have inspired us. So this topic is generosity. It's a beautiful topic. And I want to start the talk with a story of one of my trips to Asia. It was actually a little bit earlier than 2009. It was about 10 years ago. And I spent some months there. And after about 5 months of travel and meditation in all around the subcontinent, I ended up spending a little time living and practicing with Buddhist nuns in a monastery in the Bay of Thailand. It was on a little island. And the monastery kind of was stacked up on this hilltop, and just absolutely glorious views of the bay and the ocean beyond. The island, though, had no source of fresh water except for rainfall, particularly monsoonal rainfall. So the monks and nuns there had built many of the structures in that monastery. You know, it's tropical, so many of them were open, right? And they had these slanted roofs, and underneath the structures, they had built cisterns or underground water-holding tanks. And every single precious drop of water was funneled by these roofs into the cisterns underneath these structures, right? And then as you go downhill towards the ocean, there were a series of underground water tanks designed to catch the overflow from the tank above them and also capture more rainfall and then overflow to the tank below. So it was like this cascading stair step of water. And eventually, if there was too much rain, the excess flowed off into the ocean. The fresh water there was used for the monastery vegetable garden up on top of the hill. And for many years, these monks and nuns lived so simply that they had excess fresh water every year. After their own farming, their own bathing, their own cooking, all of that. And so they would offer fresh water to the villagers on the island. And the villagers would use it for their own gardens and their own farms. It's kind of beautiful, isn't it? Well, of course, the villagers also had a relationship with the monastery besides that. They came to hear the teachings. And so a lot of the food that they grew ended up coming back to the monastery in the form of these absolutely staggering meals. I happened to be there over the New Year, 2007 to 2008, and New Year's is a big deal in Thailand. So a bunch of lay people came, and the food that they grew turned into these amazing dishes that were just piled high on bowls. And we were all sitting on the floor, at least all of us except for the abbot and a senior monk or two. And the food would go by on these little carts, and you took as much as you could because you got one meal, right? So these little carts were just stacked. Lay people and monastics all shared in this feast together. It wasn't just for the monks and nuns. And no one ate a bite until the very most junior child in the village and the most junior novice in the monastery had their plate in front of them or their bowl in front of them. And then everyone would share. It's a sweet memory for me because it's just one example of many different kinds of interdependent generosity that I saw when I was in Asia between the Buddhist community and the lay community. It was just this constant interchange. And also, from a Buddhist perspective, there are different forms of generosity in this story that are important to consider when we recall and meditate on generosity. So I'm going to go through a few of those. The first is that across Southeast Asia and India and Bhutan, lay people and monastics equally consider sharing the Dhamma that the monastics do to be an act of generosity. And it's a very particular kind of act of generosity. It's an act of generosity that's out of the intention of compassion. And that motivation in Buddhist teachings, compassion is actually considered the highest intention for a gift. In his book, which I did not bring with me tonight, but Bhikkhu Anālayo wrote a book recently on compassion and emptiness. And he underscores this, saying that to offer teachings out of compassion is so common that it's become the standard phrasing used in the formal request for teachings that's used in most monasteries. He goes on to write that in the Pali texts and also in the very earliest Chinese parallels to the Pali texts, anukampa, the kind of organic compassion that arises when our hearts meet suffering, is the kind of compassion that motivates action. And that, in a number of the very earliest discourses, is said by the Buddha to be the main motivation for his teaching and the main motivation that he requests those he taught to teach to have. There's also other kinds of gifts in this story, though. So we've got the lay people coming out of gratitude for the teachings. That's one kind of gift. There's the gift of the alms food itself. And a lovely scholar, Reiko Onuma, also talks about other levels of gifts like this and beyond this. They're covered in the Siri Jataka, the Jataka tales. Alms food and other requisites are sort of the material level, and that's an important level, right? We couldn't function without that level. She writes of these other forms as well. One is the gift of renunciation that monastics make in dedicating their lives to the Dharma, or that lay practitioners make in dedicating their lives to either this Dharma or perhaps to an ideal, a cause, a community, a career that is bigger than oneself. It's this idea of dedication, of giving over. There's another kind of renunciation as gift in that little story too, though. These monks and nuns, some of them used, it wasn't much more than a bowl this size of water a day. It was absolutely amazing. Now, that doesn't count the drinking, but like bathing and other like sundry things, they really chose to live with this radical simplicity in order to share. Very socially and environmentally generous act. Generosity doesn't have to be physical, though. There's a lovely Buddhist scholar, Jan Natier, who studies a lot of the Mahayana scriptures. And she talks about bodhisattva generosity in the Mahayana ideal. And that comes to its perfection as a generosity of attitude. It's a fundamental shift internally. And it's a shift towards giving oneself completely to the service of others. Relinquishing one's own trajectory in order to open the door for everybody else. This exists in Theravada Buddhism as well, but it's in a more simpler form. That attitude is still there. Scholar Richard Gombrich talks about the fact that this idea of renunciation and generosity are often linked, or relinquishment and generosity are often linked. But it's not just a renunciation type of practice. What does it feel like when we give? Right? It can feel like a renunciation, but often it feels bigger than that, more open than that. Like I'd said earlier, generosity is kind of an aspirational practice, and in the suttas and in Buddhist countries, it's often inspired by the Buddha himself, so it kind of intersects with Buddha Nusati, contemplation of the Buddha in that way. But it's not just the Buddha's generosity in sharing the path that can be inspiration, right? One person's generosity can inspire another person's or an entire community's. On the drive down here from Berkeley, I was listening to NPR and they had a challenge grant on, right? We like this stuff. We like hearing about other people giving. It's like, oh, maybe I'll do that too. In ancient Buddhism, generosity also kind of had a special place, and that persists in Thailand and Burma and other countries to this day. It was considered a form of practice that's especially fruitful for lay people and busy lay people, as a matter of fact. Just as the ethical accumulation of wealth was considered a perfectly fine practice and still is in Buddhism, it was also considered perfectly fine for practitioners to consider worldly benefits to generosity. So in this series, you guys have been focused on Anguttara Nikaya, right? And the sixth, I can't remember, 6.5 maybe, is that right? Earlier in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's actually a little bit about the practical and worldly benefits to the givers of generosity. It's in the Siha Sutta. That's Anguttara 5.34 for people who like to read this stuff. And in that sutta, the Buddha lists four benefits for generous people that can be seen here and now in this life. And he's having this discussion with someone who's a big benefactor in the community, and the benefactor is agreeing with him, yeah, I experienced that, and yeah, I experienced that too. The first is that one is dear and agreeable to many people. That's kind of nice, isn't it? The next is that good people of integrity will admire and seek out the company of that generous person. The third is that one will enjoy a good wider reputation in the community. And the fourth, which seems to me to be very much linked to the first three, is that it promotes a certain kind of inner confidence and composure socially, and deeper than that, but in particular, a composure and confidence in approaching any group of people or assembly of people is something that that person will have. The fifth benefit was not worldly. It was an auspicious rebirth, which I guess in some cases one can give to get a little bit, as long as you're not codependent about it. So in the early suttas, you're not expected to ignore practical worldly benefits, anyway, of being a generous person. And there's another kind of generosity that's considered to be special, that has a liberative potential. And that is open-handed generosity. And by open-handed, I mean without any sense of reciprocity or even acknowledgement. Anonymous gifts, for example. Gifts of intention. Secret gifts, even. So these gifts, given without any expectation at all, are considered particularly sacred. They release someone from the normal cycle of exchange and expectation, and in some sense, the samsaric type of cycle, right? This is even embedded in our language. What do we call someone who's open-handedly generous? They're selfless, right? So just because unreciprocated generosity is sacred or selfless doesn't mean it has to look special. We have a whole lot of little examples in our lives, any daily life. I was just seeing it the other day on the Bay Bridge. I saw someone pay it forward for the next person in the toll booth. You know, I was in the fast track lane, so we don't actually have the opportunity to do that in the fast track lane, but I saw someone else do it, and it just made this like little burst of happiness. It's like, oh, look at that. People offer food to the destitute, little kindnesses to strangers. And one really beautiful thing about that is noticing the ripple effect. It has a ripple effect. And sometimes we actually get to see it directly. Sometimes, like with the challenge grant, you hear about it. And other times, maybe you take it on faith. It's also helpful for me in recollecting or getting ready to recollect generosity to be mindful of its opposite. Right? What does it feel like to be miserly, to cling, to hold back, to be guarded? I can actually feel the change in my chest as I say those words. Maybe check it out in your own body too. What does it feel like in your body to imagine the offer versus the clench? It's different. Sometimes it's working with the clench that's important. I wish I could remember which podcast I heard this on, but I honestly don't. And I'm going to relay the story because it's so beautiful anyway. This woman was talking about, like, her and her husband had gone to another town, somewhere they didn't usually live, because he had a teaching gig for a semester at the local college. And she was a writer, or some sort of freelancer, so she would just hang out at the nearby coffee shop and do her thing while he was teaching his class, and then they'd reconnoiter afterwards. So she went to the same coffee shop several times a week, weekly, you know, for months. And from the very beginning, she began to notice this young man, clearly homeless, who was just kind of hanging out on that block. And at first, you know, she did what so many of us do. That. Don't look him in the eye. Don't engage. And then after weeks of seeing the same person, she finally got curious, like, what is his story? He was about the age of the college students, right? And one day, that clench let loose. And she looked up from her table. She had an outside table that day. And she said, would you like to join me for a cup of coffee? And they sat together. And she talked a little bit to break the ice and to cover her own, release her own discomfort. She was talking about her husband and their family. And she said, "What about your family?" And he said, "Well, I haven't talked to my mom or dad in 2 years. There'd been some kind of argument, and he'd run away. And as the conversation unfolded, it came out that he really didn't have much to say to his dad, but he really missed his mother. And she said, "Do you remember her phone number?" And he said, "Yes." And the woman picked up her cell phone, turned it on, and handed it to him. And he dialed. A short conversation. The mother's crying was audible, even across the table. And they exchanged "I love yous" and hung up. And this woman in the coffee shop walked that young man to the bus station, bought him a ticket, and put him on a bus home. She doesn't know, when she relayed this story on the podcast, if he made it home or not, or what happened after he got home. It's just kind of beautiful to imagine the ripple effect, possibility. There are more sort of prosaic and longer-term examples of generosity, too, in our culture, right? Caregivers, paid and unpaid. School teachers, nonprofit workers, habitual Good Samaritans, all those types. And this whole notion of unreciprocated generosity got me thinking about how do we differentiate the spiritually mature unreciprocated generosity from overextension and burnout, compassion fatigue, horrible name. Compassion empathy fatigue is perhaps better. Buddhist principles have a little bit of guidance there too, I think. One is the idea that generosity to oneself is key and included and valid. Just like compassion to oneself is included and valid. It's a form of wisdom to ground in one's own capacity before reaching out to help others. There's also something really beautiful, just like in that interplay between the Sangha and the community I talked about, of learning to see the generosity in receiving from others. This was a lesson that took me a long time to learn, friends. But receiving actually gives other people the opportunity to give and to feel wanted, needed, connected. There's also this notion of mutual benefit, that as long as there's a helper and a helpee, there's a division. But if generosity is offered with a spirit of interest and curiosity and openness, that there's an automatic mutual benefit, an interdependence, a co-arising, if you will, of giving and receiving that can happen if we're open to the learning. And there's also the rhythm of generosity and re-nourishment itself. Rumi has a little bit to say about that. Have you been making yourself shallow with making others eminent? Just remember, when you're in union, you don't have to fear you'll be drained. The command comes to speak, and you feel the ocean moving through you. And then it comes, be silent. As when the rain stops and the trees in the orchard draw up moisture into themselves, taking nourishment into yourself. This rhythm can often be sussed out by vedana or feeling tone of how it feels to contemplate or engage in acts of generosity and how it feels to receive or stay quiet and stay within. Vedana is also one helpful way to approach the formal practice of recollecting generosity. Notice how it feels in your heart, in your body. So let's give it a try for a few minutes. How does that sound? You can stay exactly as you are if you like, or you can get into meditation posture. Just close your eyes and feel into your body for a minute. Notice what's here. Especially tap in, though, to your core, your heart center, your belly. And then take a moment to consider something that you've done that's generous. It can be material, or a gift of presence, or a way of living. Remember how it felt to do it. And if you noticed any benefits to yourself or others from it, take a moment and recollect that too. It's okay to smile. Savor. Even celebrate a little bit. Celebrate and savor any good feelings. Sometimes it can be helpful to even imagine a gesture of generosity moving out of the heart. Breathing in and receiving any of the sensations or positive feelings that come from this recollection. And breathing out, and letting go of any expectation. When exploring this practice, you may find recollection of generosity very similar to cultivating loving kindness. Notice if there's any kindness inside of you right now. And whenever you're ready, you can choose to open your eyes or just stay as you are as I keep chatting away. I'm going to close this talk with another short story from that same monastery. I was the only Westerner there, and I was pretty much left to my own devices most of the time. I was given a stack of books and sent off to practice, and we did our work meditation. But each night, all of us women got together, and in this open porch, tropical style building, we chanted a dedication and a transference of merit of the day's practice to the rest of the world. The nuns' voices were pure and clear and beautiful. And every stanza trembled with this kind of humility and faith and generosity. And during the chant, we would use this little two-part container. It had a vase and a bowl. And the water would be poured out of the vase into the bowl. At the end of the ceremony, one nun would turn out the simple fluorescent bulb, and most of us white-clad women would walk out barefoot outside under millions and millions of stars and find a tree or a plant to give the water to. The pouring the water from one vessel or another was to consecrate a certain kind of generosity. Generosity of spirit, of giving away the benefits of the practice. It symbolized the goodness of the practice as it pours from one individual vessel of the Dharma into another, right? It was an act of faith on this island with no fresh water except for that rain. But the water was absorbed by the plants or evaporated back to the sky and eventually returned as rain the next year. If not to that island, then to another one. It became this sublime cycle of oceanic generosity. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.